Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning. Thank you for joining me for another exciting episode of New Book Network's African American Studies podcast. I am your host, Katrina Anderson. Today, I am joined by Soumya Krishnamurthy, who is a music journalist and whose work can be found in Rolling Stone, Billboard, XXL, Playboy, Complex, New York Magazine, The Village Voice, and Time. She is also a host and pop culture expert, and she has appeared on The Breakfast Club, MTV, MSNBC, VH1, Hot 97, Apple Music, E, BET, CNN, NPR, and BBC. She has launched and hosted The Lookout by SoundCloud on Sirius XM. Today, we are discussing her magnificent first book, Fashion Killer, How Hip-Hop Revolutionized High Fashion, which is out now. So thank you for joining me today, Ms. Krishnamurthy.
Thank you so much for having me.
So can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Yes. So Fashion Killer is the first hip-hop fashion retrospective covering 50 years. So yes, hip-hop is officially middle-aged this year, and it spans from 1973 all the way to 2023. It has a nice bookend with Pharrell getting his new position at Louis Vuitton. And what I really wanted to do with this book is showcase just like the depth and the importance of this topic of hip-hop fashion. Oftentimes when we think of this subject matter, I think it's done through this very sort of cursory lens. And I wanted to delve deeper into the culture, history, sociology, and all these other facets that really played a part in how our favorite artists dressed, as well as how they impacted the way we dress and the world at large. And to me, that was really important to showcase. Of course, you're going to get some of your favorite moments, Little Kim at the MTV Video Music Awards, Biggie wearing Versace. You're going to have all of those moments, but let's go behind the scenes and dive deeper. So whether you're a hip hop head, you love fashion, or just someone who truly is an academic and wants to learn about the subject matter, I really think this book has appeal across the board.
And I can definitely say, as someone who loves hip hop and who loves fashion and who's also in academia, it does. I mean, the appeal is, it is relevant in all of those areas. So as you were doing your research, what was your source base? What were you looking at?
The source base really ran the gamut. So it's everything from academic journals to old magazine articles, such as Vibe magazine, The Source. If you're an old hip hop magazine head, you're definitely going to have a little bit of nostalgia. Of course, newspapers, interviews. I mean, I would watch hours of podcasts like Drink Champs, for example, just to extract one little tidbit or one little quote. So this was very, very heavily researched. And again, if you're going to write the definitive book, I think research is so integral. And for every chapter, I want to say there was about 40 sources. So it was very, very heavily resourced. Now, of course, there were interviews as well. So as a journalist, I've been able to interview a variety of artists, designers, industry insiders, and people behind the scenes. And for this book, I think I hit over 100 interviews. Of course, you don't use every interview when you're writing a book, but I did quite a bit of interviews. And it was everyone from Pusha T and Pharrell to A$AP Rocky, Tommy Hilfiger, Cameron, Carl Kanai. I mean, there's a lot of bold-faced names, as well as a lot of people behind the scenes. So if you're an industry insider, there's going to be certain names that maybe aren't known within the public space, but once you read it, you're truly going to feel like an industry insider.
I did. I mean, I was like, wow. You know, every time I was reading this, I was like, oh, I remember those moments. But then it was those behind the scene clips that I really understood what that represented. And you were able to show that to me. Now, as you were researching, and it was a very lengthy investigative process for you, was there anything that surprised you?
I think what surprised me was truly how in-depth this topic was. It's funny because when you write a nonfiction book, one part of the proposal is actually putting together what the blueprint of the book is going to be. And I had marked out what the 16 chapters would be. And for the most part, I did adhere to that. But once you get into the actual research process, you might interview somebody, for example, and then they say something and that totally takes you into another rabbit hole. Or you're watching a documentary thinking, okay, I'm going to glean so much information and there's absolutely nothing. And you've got to sort of shift courses and go into another direction. So that happened a couple of times. And I think it served the book well because there were certain chapters that ended up coming from the research that I initially hadn't conceived. So I think when you write a book, of course, having that map really does help because otherwise the topic can be so expansive. But by the same token, I think you also have to be a little bit open to the fact that a certain conversation or a tidbit or a footnote can sometimes take you in a completely different direction and will benefit the book. So also being sort of free in that manner, I think, was important.
And you did an excellent job of that. And I was thinking, in particular, you know, you're discussing, you examine like the history of fashion laws, you know, the sumptuary laws that were on the books. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, for me, it was really important to dive into this notion of luxury. So, of course, just defining what luxury is within our context, but also going into this history of it. What is haute couture? What does that even mean? It's a legally protected term in Paris, for example. But also this idea of luxury being a part of social signaling and aspiration. And then again, let's go deeper. Well, why would somebody, for example, want to dress in a certain way to show that they're of a certain class or socioeconomic stature? Well, if you go back far enough, there was a time when there were laws essentially stating who could wear what. Of course, in Europe, it had to do a lot with things like royalty and different classes. But once we get into America, a lot of it was very much almost, I don't even want to say coded because it was very much out in the open of discrimination against people who were enslaved versus people who were free. And sometimes it would be certain fabrics, even like the color of certain fabrics would showcase where somebody was within society. And I think that was important to begin the book. I believe it's chapter 2 where we dive into those sumptuary laws because it sort of puts a stake in the ground of this idea of luxury is not relegated only to hip hop, or this idea that in America everyone is so capitalistic and materialistic. Well, let's go deeper. Where does that come from? And so much of it is steeped into things like socioeconomics and class, race. I mean, much more larger, heavy topics that very much play into the remainder of the book. So that was important. Because again, as I said, with this topic, showcasing the gravitas of it, showcasing how significant it is, very much part of that is displaying the history and showing that it isn't just this last 50 years of hip hop, but we're going back generations and really centuries.
And you did that so well. And that, excuse me, leads me to the next question. You talk a lot about Harlem. And you take it all the way back, you know, to the importance of the city and what that meant, especially the historical importance, because you talk about the Harlem Renaissance and what that was and with the artists and the musicians during that time. And so you did that so masterfully. Can you talk about how that fit into your idea of what you wanted to discuss and bring into the conversation as you were talking about fashion in New York?
So in hip hop, there's always this debate of, in New York, who is the flyest, best looking borough? And of course, everybody thinks it's their borough where they're from. But I think we can all agree that Harlem has the most fashionable people, whether it's Dapper Dan, to Cameron, ASAP Rocky. I mean, there's that long lineage of people from Harlem. So again, we could have just talked about that, starting with Dapper Dan and his atelier. But to showcase this true holistic story, it was so important to go into why Harlem. So just the fact that how it started as this neighborhood in Manhattan, that it became an epicenter during Black migration, and it was a place of Black wealth, this idea of Black excellence, which we talk about now, but that was truly embodied and displayed in that neighborhood. And during the Harlem Renaissance, we're seeing this alchemy of art, literature, fashion, business, all of this kind of come together, politics. I mean, so many bold-faced names come from that era. And again, it was just important to show that lineage. So we can't talk about Dapper Dan without talking about the ancestors before. Similarly, we can't talk about an ASAP Rocky without talking about the ancestors before. So that was just a really important sort of through line to show that it isn't something that is just kind of colloquialism that, yeah, artists from Harlem, they're really flamboyant and flashy and they're great dressers, but there's a history behind that. And again, it just kind of goes deeper than oftentimes what that surface level conversation is.
And that's what you did. But New York wasn't your only focus, which I really appreciated. You included other geographic areas. How important was that for you in the book?
It was incredibly important for me. I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in a small town in the Midwest. So although I love East Coast hip hop, it's what I grew up on, I also know what it's like to sort of have a outsider's perspective. And oftentimes when we talk about hip hop, especially through a historical context, it can be very New York centric, very male centric, and it just reflects sort of the bias of the fact that New York is where hip hop started. But for this book, it was so important to showcase the West Coast, the South, these other regions, as well as voices that oftentimes aren't amplified within this narrative. So of course, we had to go to the West Coast, and that's when we're talking about swap meets and gang culture, but also things like Mexican-American culture and how that affected the way that people out there dress. The South, I sort of told the story as it relates to artists like Andre 3000 and Young Thug. And that was a way to also discuss things like the way that they push gender and sexuality boundaries and the way that they dressed. So it was very important to showcase this much more larger, expansive perspective. Now, of course, America is the epicenter, but the book does spend a lot of time in Europe, Paris, Milan, London, places like that, as well as Japan for the streetwear chapter. So right now where we are, I mean, hip hop is the biggest genre, but it's also a global genre. So it wouldn't have been doing, it would have been a disservice to not showcase truly the international aspect of the story. So this really starts in New York, but takes you around the globe.
Well, what I really liked, you know, as I was reading the book, you begin your conversation with Dapper Dan, yet you come full circle to him. How, you know, can you speak a bit about his role in hip hop and fashion?
Dapper Dan is very much a godfather of hip hop fashion. He's the father of logomania. That's that, according to him. But he was someone who really took this idea of customization and creating bespoke fashion, utilizing the logos of heritage houses like Louis Vuitton, MCM, Chanel, all of those. And what he did very interestingly, as we're getting into the 80s and into those early 90s, is creating fashion that spoke to his customers. So whether it be an artist like an LL Cool J or Big Daddy Kane, or an athlete like Mike Tyson, I mean, they wanted to wear Louis Vuitton, but they wanted a certain silhouette. Maybe it's baggier. Maybe there's extra pockets. He had a big clientele with people who were in the street. So someone like a drug dealer might want like the bulletproof lining in the snorkel. So those are things that he really was able to customize and create for his clientele. What's interesting is people often talk about him as creating knockoffs, but he says they were knockups because they were usually more expensive than the Heritage House. So that's kind of interesting. Dapper Dan was famously raided over and over again by all these Heritage Houses. Finally, in 92, Fendi was the final nail in the coffin. And for a long time, he went underground. It was only really a handful of years ago he made a resurgence when Gucci took one of his old designs that was created for Olympian Diane Dixon and walked it down the runway. And that was when social media and certain fashion editors were really, you know, in a tizzy that you're copying his style, you're not giving him credit. And through a lot of sort of controversy and headlines, eventually Gucci, you know, did apologize. And now they're in an official partnership with Dapper Dan. They helped him create an atelier in Harlem that was I was able to visit. So that's really where kind of his story and the book ends, with visiting him in that atelier, being able to go there. It's very much like a living museum. And it shows this kind of full circle moment, not just for him, but where we are sort of with hip hop's relation to luxury.
Now, do you see the 1990s as kind of like those? And as I was reading the book, I couldn't help but think how much change happened in the 1990s. Do you see like that period in history as really redefining what hip hop and fashion were? And I remember I lived through this somewhat. I was still like a teenager, but I remember those moments. Do you see that time period as when things were changing so much?
Absolutely. The 90s marked a really interesting time for hip hop because I think that's when we just saw the genre explode into the mainstream. So because of things like MTV, magazines like Vibe and Rolling Stone, all of a sudden, hip hop is becoming something part of the mainstream conversation versus seeing it as more of a New York thing or an LA thing, kind of relegated to just the underground or a niche culture. There's also, with that hand in hand, is just the commercialization. So all of a sudden, artists weren't just performers, but many of them were running record labels. So you had some, you know, labels like Bad Boy with Puff, Rockefeller with Jay-Z, Rough Riders, Cash Money. I mean, the list goes on and on. And you're starting to see the artist as the entrepreneur. And that directly feeds into the explosion of fashion. So now artists are realizing, I have this huge mainstream appeal. We're making more money, selling more records than we've ever done before. But on top of that, why am I propagating someone else's name brand? I can create my own fashion line and make a lot of money doing it. And it becomes a part of sort of this cultural footprint of the artist. So the 90s were very seminal in that, insofar as just the explosion of hip hop, but also the rise of hip hop entrepreneurialism in the fashion space.
Well, as we were talking about the 90s, we have to talk about Dame Dash and Jay-Z's Rockaware. What can you say about their role in fashion during that time?
Well, what I love about Rockaware is it really began out of necessity, which is very much part of the hip hop ethos. If somebody doesn't invite you to the table, you create your own table, that kind of mentality and that hustler's DNA, which is very much a part of hip hop. So when I interviewed Dame, he told me a funny story that initially they had approached this company, Iceberg, which was very popular around that 90s time, to basically, you know, do something with Jay-Z. He already loves your clothes. At this point, he was a viable enough artist that it wouldn't have been far-fetched for Iceberg to work with him. Now, according to Dame, Iceberg basically told them, absolutely not, and you can go to the sample sale. And, you know, to hear the way Dame says it is pretty funny. And of course, that puts the battery in his back. Well, we'll show you. And that were really the seeds of starting Rockaware. Jay's from Brooklyn. Dame is from Harlem. So again, going back to this idea of sartorialism and dressing well, being very much a part of who he is. And they created this line. And I think it was this ideal time of creating a fashion line. And what they had that was very much used to their benefit was this whole roster of artists who basically became their models. So you have Jay-Z wearing it in music videos. You have Kanye wearing it in a magazine shoot. Cameron and Dipset wearing it on the red carpet. I mean, it really was this idea that we have this incredibly big roster. These guys are already superstars. You throw Rockaware on them and it's like a walking ad. I remember watching all those music videos as a kid growing up and not even realizing I was basically watching ads, right, for hours on end. But that was something that these hip hop clothing lines, and I think Rockaware especially, were able to do very well. They already knew their sort of cultural power and they leveraged it within the hip hop space.
Hunter, I do remember, as you were saying, that growing up and watching the videos on MTV and BET, and I remember, excuse me, like Aaliyah and the Tommy Hilfiger. And I remember like, oh my gosh, that's so cool. I want to buy those clothes during that time, because it was, you know, this is before the advent of social media. You had those music videos and you had those music award shows. And that's how, you know, for me, that's how I connected to fashion during that time. It was by watching that. It's like, I want to wear those clothes. That was it. It was like, I see it right there. I want to put that on. That's how I want to dress. And it's so, you know, it's so interesting as you look back into that, you know, historically now, because you do have the advent of social media now, which changed the game a lot of ways in and of itself. But it was thinking about before that, where things were and how much that influenced us during that time. It was really great to read about that in your book, and it brought back some fond memories, I will say, for myself of my youth as I was reading through your book. I was like, yeah, I remember those moments there, which brings me to my next topic, women. That's something that you delve into wholeheartedly in the book, and you talk about women and their role in hip hop and fashion, and I can see how important it was for you to include that. Can you speak a little bit about that?
It was incredibly important to include women. It's funny, we talk about fashion and it's an industry that's in many ways dominated by a female consumer base, but the voices of women are usually very much minimized when it comes to this topic. So I knew from jump that I wanted to, of course, spotlight artists like Lil' Kim, Foxy Brown, Missy Elliott, but also to talk to designers, people like April Walker or Kimora Lee Simmons, as well as those people behind the scenes. Some of the most interesting conversations I had were with people like stylist Misa Hilton or the Source fashion editors like Julia Chance and Sonia Maje, who were there when someone like a Tyson Beckford was being discovered in the pages of The Source. So it was very important for me to show the contributions of women and also to show that it wasn't just sort of relegated to one chapter. You hear female voices throughout this book. And that was important and very necessary, because even though we are celebrating Hip Hop 50, I can tell you from an industry perspective, there have been people who have criticized that we're not hearing enough from women. Women still feel like a footnote. And in this book, they absolutely are not a footnote. They're very much important power players who were integral in this whole story and this whole narrative.
I agree. They weren't marginalized in any way in your book. They were actually central to the narrative that you created. And, you know, as I was reading about Lil' Kim and I was reading those chapters, I was like, she's, in my mind, she's such a style icon. You know, I just see her influence so many ways. And you mentioned earlier that VMA moment, but her sense of style. I just remember watching her videos, No Time, and the way that she was dressed. And I was like, wow, that's so innovative. Can you speak a little bit about her influence?
Yeah, Lil' Kim is 1,000% a fashion icon. And I think from day one, she was someone who was very fearless in how she embraced clothing, whether it be furs, jewelry, designer clothes, sunglasses, accessories, but also the idea of embracing her skin and her sexuality. I mean, who can forget those famous posters for Hardcore when she first came out? I think a lot of parents groups were up in arms about that. But throughout her career, whether it be at the VMAs, whether it's the cover of Interview Magazine where she's covered in the Louis Vuitton monogram, she's somebody who's just been very much a aficionado of fashion, but also the high fashion world has loved her. She's been a muse for people like Donatella Versace and Marc Jacobs, people who she calls close friends to this day. And that was very unique. For her, it wasn't just this idea of being a fashion consumer or a fan, but the fashion industry, I think, was very much just excited by who is this little dynamo with the big voice, the big records. And she exudes all of those things that high fashion loves, from just being fearless to being very sex positive, gorgeous, sexy, all of these things very much resonated in that world. So there you did see more of a symbiosis. It's funny, as I've been doing interviews for this book, I mean, Little Kim comes up all the time. And it's also this question of, has she gotten her flowers from the fashion industry? She never got a cover of American Vogue. She was never awarded any big accolade by the fashion industry. So in many ways, I feel like this book is kind of campaigning for her to have that moment at this stage. And I think the timing makes a lot of sense.
I think so, too. I think she needs those accolades because she was a trendsetter from the get-go. I mean, she was out there in the forefront, and she was with those luxury labels. And as you said, she inspired them. So I'm wholeheartedly on board for that because she was definitely, and she still is, a style icon to this day. So I want to ask you, where do you see hip-hop and fashion now in our current era, in 2023?
I think the journey has very much been from outsider to insider. So the book starts with this idea of rappers not even being able to afford luxury clothes, to then having this relationship almost like a consumer buying the clothes. Some people did become designers. But now what we're seeing is with people like Pharrell or Virgil Abloh, those from the hip hop world coming into the high fashion fold and having these positions at places like a Louis Vuitton as creative directors, as very much kind of these celebrity front and center positions. So I think it's interesting. In the future, I would love to see a hip hop line becoming its own standalone heritage American line in the vein of, let's say, a Ralph Lauren or a Tommy Hilfiger. I think that would be incredible. But I think right now we're in an age of collaboration. Artists want to work with these big brands. Big brands want to work with these artists. And from a financial perspective and a creative perspective, I think it makes a lot of sense. So in many ways, we've kind of come full circle with this story. But I think what's also really interesting is culture is constantly living and breathing. So the story's continuing to be written. And as hip-hop just changes and evolves and grows and shifts and old becomes new and new becomes old, we're going to see this story continue to change. And I think that's what makes it really exciting.
I think so, too. I definitely agree with that, Ms. Krishnamurthy. So what would you want readers to take away from the book?
I would say that I would love for them to just see how important hip hop and fashion is, and the fact that it truly is not just a hip hop story or a fashion story, but it's an American story. This is American history. This is American culture. And I think when you read this book, you'll truly get that appreciation. And then beyond that, seeing the fact that it's also a global story and it's international, spanning generations and eras and trends and seasons, and just showing how expansive it is, I think is also really important. I think if you're somebody who loves hip hop, it's going to be a walk down memory lane. You're going to want to pull out some clothes from storage and maybe put those back on. And I love that. I love hearing people say that it takes them back to a different time when they were younger, or just kind of a simpler time. So that's fun as well. And I think if you're somebody who is a complete neophyte, you're going to read this book and just get such a great understanding and appreciation for hip hop as well as for hip hop fashion. And I promise you, you're going to dress a little bit better after reading this book.
I agree, Ms. Krishnamurthy. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Fashion Killa is out everywhere. So everybody out there, please read it, love it. People have been sharing just kind of the book on their bookshelves or them carrying it around like an accessory. So I love to see it. And I'm just super excited for everybody to read it and just appreciative for all the love.
Readers, please go out. I second that, and pick up a copy of Fashion Killer today. It is holiday time now. This is something that is for academics. It's for non-academics. It's on sale now. And as Ms. Krishnamurthy says, maybe you will dress a little better, but if you're a historian or a scholar, you want to know the history of fashion and hip hop. So please, I implore you, you will not regret picking up this book. Go out and pick up a copy now.